Hey, IP note, anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributors to any CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. And you need a W3 web account. It's free before joining any individual group. And community groups are free. So it's only working groups and above where you start to have to worry about membership and stuff. The community W3C community contributor license agreement text is pasted here. And that's just FYI, if you're looking for information before joining the group. Call notes, these minutes and an audio recording of everything said on this call are archived at our CCG meetings repo that's available in this location. And in the the VCEDU group page, I actually have links to just the EDU ones if you're ever interested in easier way to filter on that. And let's see, so all of this other stuff is now irrelevant. I recommend, and it sort of depends on how many people are here, you can either use Zoom raised hand if there seems to be a lot of, if it's more convenient for you or there seems to be a lot of activity, feel free to just type Q plus into chat like this, like we used to do. And yeah, we'll catch you. Okay, are there any new people that would like to introduce themselves? Feel free to just speak up.
This is Timothy Ruff. I'm a first timer. I know a few of you and really just excited to be here and hear what's going on. It seems like you guys have some good momentum, and I have followed some of the notes from previous meetings going back, looks like several years. So excited to listen and see what you guys.
Okay. And reintroductions. This is the opportunity if you've sort of switched focuses recently, you're wanting to tell the group like what you're now interested in, you can reintroduce yourself. Okay, so we have a lot of people I recognize, so I think we can just go ahead and get started. We have a lot of stuff to cover. First, let's get to the DOE wallet overview. And then we'll talk about the modeling educational verifiable credentials open issues. Okay, for context, actually, and I'll share my screen, but just so you have the slide deck as well. The permission should be set. Anyone with link can open it. Let me know if there's a problem with opening it, but I'll share as we go as well. For this, so, Other presentations, we've talked about sort of the context of the DOE Learner Wallet. This one, we're going to dive in pretty quickly into the approach. If you're interested in learning more about the context, then just let me know. There's some other presentations we can cover. Okay, sharing my screen. Okay, so the DOE Learner Wallet, it is a Department of Education funded effort. And the original idea behind it was there are a set of at-risk schools where it would be beneficial to use this kind of technology that we're building, learner controlled records. Let's actually try this out on some real higher educational institutions. And as we've gone, so we're still in the process. This is a joint work of MIT and DOE figuring out some pilot partners and they need to be, there's a list of criteria, but it's basically we want to sort of cover a broader set of scenarios and make sure that the learners really can be able to exchange them in a verifiable credentials ecosystem. So it's a very short, aggressive time span. So what are the deliverables of it? Is a learner wallet standard. So keep in mind that the word standard is used very loosely here. It's a draft standard that we are all familiar with that groups like this can come up with. And then over time, we turn over to actual standards track groups. then an open source wallet code base and detailed documentation of that. Once the higher educational institution partners are identified, deploy the open source wallet as a reference implementation, and then evaluate the implementation efficacy and learner perception. So time frame, this is supposed to be rolled out roughly by all finished around end of late next spring, sort of early summer-ish, but there's phased deliverables in between. This is a lot of work for a short amount of time. And so the good thing is that, our Department of Education partner behind it, Sharon Liu, is working closely with our other, what I call well-intentioned, benevolent government contacts here. And Anil John, for example, from DHS, has done a lot of work to drive forward the verifiable credential interoperability test suite through his DHS SVIP fund. And so the way that we've been approaching this is what I call building a minimum spanning tree, connecting the work that this group has done and the work of the CCG, Decentralized Identity Foundation, T3 Network, getting things connected in terms of standards that we can actually build on existing efforts and complement them and make sure it's an ongoing growing effort. So with that in mind, I want to first talk through the foundations of the approach, and then we'll get a little more specific. So I see sort of two core foundations and then one core alignment is roughly speaking. So yes, you can view it as a draft standard and reference implementation, but it's strongly based on two items. One of these is the LER wallet/wrapper spec that people who are familiar with the T3 Innovation Network are probably familiar with. It defines two things. And I think, so Jim Goodell was a lead author on this. And what he described is two things. One is a way to express a wide variety of educational learner worker claims embedded into this LER wrapper, which is basically a verifiable credentials. So that was really critical for bridging verifiable credentials to things like PESC XML transcripts, open badges, things like that. So some of that work in terms of more detailed mapping we're continuing in this effort, but this is a really good foundation for just, making things work out of the box. Now, in addition to the payload data models, it outlines a set of functional requirements, which I realize that's a really good set of requirements to base this effort on. So it called out functional requirements, but out of scope was specifically how that's happening. So I see this effort as starting to chip away and talk about how to accomplish those functional requirements. The second foundation is the Universal Wallet Interop spec. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. Basically, the Universal Wallet Interop spec, we've probably talked about many times, but it's a foundation for a wide variety of digital wallets. So this isn't the same thing as a learner wallet. Rather, learner wallet would be based on this universal wallet, but it basically allows interoperability across broader array of wallet standards. So it's very, very important to align with that because it helps increase the way that learners can actually use their records. Let me see. So yeah, the Universal Wallet Interop spec is both a interface and an implementation. You don't have to use the implementation, but you can. It's a way to save a lot of time. So the way that we're planning to use it is doing all the work that can be done at that layer, do that. And then lastly, the DHS SVIP interop test suites is a really useful model for helping prove interoperability across different approaches. So, before these test suites were developed, it was really difficult to know. I'm a company that makes a product that issues verifiable credentials, and you do the same. But how do we really know all of our stuff works together? So that was actually a lot of work to do. But through this program, there was developed a set of issuer APIs and verifier APIs that a broad array of issuers, verifier libraries could actually test against to ensure that there is interoperability. So we see this as a really important foundation to use and continue. And note that all of these efforts are really things that we want to invest in, because independent of this particular project, these are the things that help ensure longevity for the overall effort. This is a more detailed list of standards and alignments, and it's not necessarily complete. So feel free to mention things that may be missing. Basically, this is an area that there's just a lot of work in progress, draft exchange request protocols we need to list. So that's going to be one of the most challenging parts of this, or interesting parts of this. So we don't have to read this, but I want to include, just for reference, in the LER wrapper wallet spec, what does it call out as the functional requirements for the wallet? And so it calls out very clearly receiving LERs, persist, select, send, and then it says what it may be able to do. So again, it says what it should do, it doesn't say how. So where this effort can really benefit is starting to fill in details of that from a LER wallet perspective, and mapping it onto verifiable credential, decentralized identifier, and related LER standards. On the identity side, it was interesting. So there's the functional, it didn't appear as much in the functional requirements, although I should probably check with Jim on this, but basically it does call out relying on a proof of control identifier that allows a specific individual to positively assert the record's authentic and it's issued to that person. So I like that framing, because that's very consistent with the fact that a verifiable credential is not restricted to taking a decentralized identifier as a subject. It takes a URI, which can be a decentralized identifier. And we know a lot of efforts are very interested in decentralized identifier based approaches, but at the same time, it's interesting to explore other methods as well. And so I think the main thing that this calls out is the value of something that a learner can prove control over. And so let's look at this view over here first. So one thing that, as I've been looking through the universal wallet spec, so the way I describe the wallet as described there is, it's kind of pretty generic and pretty dumb in a way. So it doesn't necessarily have a concept of, well, this is something we're still debating, like whether the wallet that we're describing there has a concept of verifiable credentials versus whether it's a separate layer that would allow it to distinguish between, okay, here's my verifiable credential wallet versus here's my digital currency wallet. But basically, it has a set of operations that are called out in the universal wallet spec. So this is a universal wallet interop spec. We have a lot of discussion on the issues happening right now about like what's the right level of granularity. Notice that there's some operations that you would expect to be common to any sort of digital wallet, like import, export, lock, unlock, query. But then there are some that are more specific to a verifiable credential wallet, like Issue Proof, whereas some are more specific to a digital currency wallet, like Transfer. So we're talking about the modeling of that, you know, and it's sort of how that manifests to this spec. But basically what we're building is this very layered approach. But then in terms of actual storage, like say when you add something to the wallet, how can you make sure that the storage can be to a wide array of backing stores? So there's a lot of different approaches that people are using, and then there's a lot of different use cases. Sometimes you want it to be stored on device. Sometimes you want it to be in a, what's it called now, confidential storage, which is the new name for identity hubs and encrypted data vaults. And so, so abstracting over that, abstracting over identity, or rather identifier methods, so that those can be pluggable. The universal wallet already calls out a sort of layer of indirection there, but we need to make that more explicit as part of this work, and then also demonstrate some appealing use cases for the examples and reference code for the use cases we come up with. In the data model, there's additionally related concepts about, you know, what would be in a universal wallet, but so we're in the process of grouping, categorizing those now. What I'm getting at is that, okay, so the wallet will consist, there's some things that are, applicable to any wallet. So there's a concept of connections. They may be used differently in a verifiable credential wallet versus a currency wallet, and profiles, which we're calling a way of grouping sets. This name won't necessarily be the final name, but it might be a way of like grouping, you know, for your academic history versus your, you know, what you want to present in a social context. Let's see. Now then up here is sort of the layer that the universal wallet doesn't really talk about right now, or rather if it does, it's sort of not as cleanly defined. So this is going to be a really interesting area where the functional requirements of the LER wallet really come in. So, and those have to do with interactions. So how do I get a credential from a from an issuer? How do I exchange it with a relying party? Other usage patterns that may be things like, you know, selective disclosure. You know, again, this is use case dependent, how much we get into it, but we want to start clarifying how this all fits into this effort. And then lastly, schema. So the universal wallet, its only awareness is a verifiable credential. But we know that as we develop, you can do richer kinds of operations if you know what's in that credential. So what are the kinds of things that people might want to do, and how can you expose that functionality? Those are the kind of things that will be interesting to cover there. Now, in terms of the interactions, there's one thing I wanted to call out, which the learning economy folks, especially Nathan and Jackson, had started, and I think I lost, like the font is super fuzzy now, so I'm going to update this document later, but basically it's calling out sort of more in a data flow perspective, you know, what the you know, flows are from issuer to holder, how does that get exchanged to the holder? And then, you know, once the holder has a verifiable credential, how do they pass on that presentation to a holder? So I'm just sort of talking to what's here. And basically, we want to bring this effort back into scope. And these items up here are not necessarily in scope of the universal wallet layer. This is sort of calling out, I think the layer is somewhere around here. And clearly there's influence, you know, like this layer will use or customize things from the lower layers, but these are the kinds of efforts that we'll be working on. So this one, I don't know what that's called yet, but that's really one of the focuses of the learner wallet that's not the universal wallet, if that makes sense. So with that, I'm going to stop there. And I wanted to see if there's any comments or discussion about the approach. Let me bring up chat now. Probably important to include smaller, might be interested rather than, yes. So that's a good point. Those facing imminent potential insolvency, obviously, that's the nightmare scenario that we're worried about. But yes, I think that it can move away from that. What recipient identifier types are compatible? So I think that where this effort can benefit the community is calling out what are good criteria, really. So we're going to have some reference implementations for the use cases, but there's other work that's happening. Let me go to this earlier slide. There's other work that's happening in terms of what makes a good learner identifier method. So the DID rubric is an attempt to call out a more general framework for aligning them. This link right here is sort of the design decisions that are the approach that we came up with when we were looking, or DCC was looking into learner identity method criteria. So things like for the learner, there are certain characteristics that you want that may not necessarily apply to the issuer. You want something that is very portable, cheap or free, ideally, very interoperable. The learner can sort of pack up their bags and leave, switch it to something else. So these are sort of the things that we want to keep building on. I noticed Nate has a raised hand. Nate?
Yeah, I'm interested more in which identifiers and proof of control protocols that partners in this work actually do want to use, rather than the criteria by which we might assess one of these things eventually. If we don't have any ideas yet of which DID methods are interesting for people to try out, it'd be hard to even formulate criteria. Are there any proof of control protocols or specific DID methods that are in view here?
The easy one to do that is just proof of control, but does not offer the longer lived options is just DID key. So that would assume that's basically not that much better than putting a public key in there, but that's free for the learner. It relies on reissuance by the issuer if in case of identity loss, so it's not ideal. So what we're doing is, so that one we consider normally either good for just demonstration or for cases where you can be guaranteed that the issuer can reissue to the learner. The other thing that I want to call out is that there can be methods outside of decentralized identifiers. There's other emerging sort of best practices around, I think Tim could probably talk to Carrie, things like that. So Carrie has a way of representing keys that are a lot like what I described, where it's a sort of a generative identifier method, but then also there's a separate notion of, sort of being able to update the keys that it points to. And so we're really open to everything at this layer. And let me see, did I answer or not answer? So basically, we're not going to give a list of these are the ones that that we accept, but we will have some reference ones, and we'll have clearer guidance about how identifier methods can be plugged into the wallet as well as criteria for learner wallets. And the criteria won't necessarily be good or bad sort of criteria. It's more like these are the characteristics to keep in mind. Let me see if there's any other hands raised. It's sort of hard for me to.
Just me.
Okay. Oh, I see one.
I was just going to add to that Carrie works in a couple different configurations, and I think it could be, depending on how you build it or how it's installed in a given place, could work with what you said previously about a sort of custodial reissuable key, or like, you know, sort of centralized recovery could be done with Carrie quite well in terms of the way I know a lot of people that are using conventional identities for now with VCs have this idea of bootstrapping existing like account management instead of key management. And so if someone needs to have their stuff reissued, they just call the existing 1-800 number of the, you know, university or identity provider and get them to rotate, you know, send a new, you know, that works really well with Carrie based DIDs. And I was going to say that one thing that's a little, one particularly important aspect in the DID rubric that might be worth thinking about early on as a functional requirement is whether or not to support or conversely even ban methods that have historical verification, in the sense of being able to look up what the key material was for a DID, you know, exactly on a specific day in history, for the purposes of verification. I know that there's some debate about this, and DID methods vary a lot on this, but the reason I mentioned it is that creates drastically different architectural assumptions, whether or not that's present or not present. So that kind of verification might be a thing that could rule out some methods. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, thanks for that. And there's two points. Like, one is that the historical verification, so on the issuer side, that is tremendously valuable because it can allow people to verify older issued credentials without reissuing it. But I'm assuming you're talking about the learner side, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, that's definitely I could see some different issues there. On the other side, so, and this touches to what Phil mentioned about PSYOP and Carrie. So yes, there's a couple things going on there, because Carrie does outline a set of cryptographic key management best practices that other decentralized identifier methods are starting to use now. So pre-rotation and things like that. So, and I think that there's a mix of, you know, there's decentralized identifiers, but then also decentralized identifiers can have flexible methods of authentication, like say using the university login, things like that. So I think that where this gets interesting is being able to talk about specifically for some learner use cases, what are some valuable things that we can do, and we can start implementing those. Are there any other discussions that I missed? Phil, you're up.
Sorry, thank you. I just wanted to clarify, when you put up the diagram with the blurry text on the right side, the upper part is about creating the credential and the VC in the first place. And the lower part is really about presentation, creating a presentation of those VCs.
That's the way
I read it. And so you're talking that yours is focused on that lower part? Your wallet?
Actually, all of it. And I'm pulling it up so that I see what happened. I got the screenshot view of it. I'm going to re-add that right now. It's kind of a mess in this full view. So okay, and I'm just gonna put it in the, I'm gonna make a new slide, put it in there. It's not gonna fit in there. And so we'll see what happens. Okay, but at least you can see the text. Oh wait, let me reshare. Yeah, so one thing in terms of that diagram on the left, they really, to the extent that we're layered on top of the universal wallet, there is some work of this effort that affects that lower layer. Let me go back to this. So here. So some of the work does affect these lower layers. A lot, the one part of it is conceptual clarity that the universal wallet needs that we can help with. But I think to a large extent, you know, we'll be able to get that to a point where we consider that kind of good enough for our purposes. And I really see most of the effort happening up here, you know, and specifically over here, sort of mapping out what are good ways to achieve these interactions. But then, you know, accepting that we're not building the one standard for all time. We want to make sure to be clear about, okay, here's this MVP, and then here are sort of where the work can continue to happen. And that touches on sort of the existing effort. So let's zoom in on that a little bit more. And yeah, we haven't updated this in a while, but basically from holder to issuer, holder might want to request verifiable credential. I'm hoping you can still see my screen. Yeah, I think so. Okay, so
yes, it's working.
Yeah, what are the bits of information that the holder would need to exchange to the issuer in order to get the verifiable credential? What are the protocols and sort of work in progress standards at each step? So we're going to be filling all of this in as combination of MVPs with roots, with connections to like where the ongoing work is happening. I think that in some cases, what we'll be doing is sort of a simpler version of specs already underway, like the DCC has done for the credential request progress process. It's really breaking down some of the more complicated standards into something like, okay, here's the core of what we need to do. Here's the both in terms of the protocol and the payloads that are relevant. So we want to use that to inform existing standards that, you know, are draft standards that may allow more complicated functionality, but also making sure it's easier to just get started with these minimal scenarios. Credential exchange, there's a few methods underway there, but I think we also want to understand how this connects to things like Badge Connect. So I think we're doing a couple things. We're getting the pipeline flows going, but then understanding how these things relate to common use cases in the EDU space. So I think a combination like filling this in with greater depth, with greater detail, and getting the MVP is really critical for, let me go back a slide, for this layer specifically. But then, you know, for each of these layers, that's basically a similar thing, usage patterns. And, you know, depending on how much we get into things like, minimal and selective disclosure, as we talked about in last week's CCG call. Let me see if we had anyone else that I'm missing. Carrie, you're up.
Hey there, I was a little bit late, so sorry if I missed this and you went over it.
Is it within the scope for learners to import their existing digital credentials?
I think it was at the beginning, it was not necessarily in scope, but I think it will end up being by virtue of a use case that we're likely to demonstrate it with, which is basically a CLR wrapped in an LER. So that's related to one of the pilots where we will likely be partnering with a vendor that is issuing CLRs. And so, we'll want to demonstrate a kind of round trip thing, like existing CLR to LER CLR, and then vice versa. So there's different characteristics that you can get each way. But I think that will be a useful demonstration of, how these can be sort of bootstrapped across. Related to that, the sort of the different properties that you get with one, how does it, in that prior method, what was the trust model? What was the means of authentication used? And then what does that mean for the new one? I think that there will be a lot of considerations that we can talk to, but then also some kind of next steps that we can prod the community on. So things like if we can do certain things to improve decentralized verification of records that are currently centralized, that could be really interesting.
Yeah, that would be very juicy, right? Cool, thank you.
Thanks. Okay, I think we should probably get to the what's it called? The VC EDU model issues next. Okay, one thing I wanted to get back to, I want to see if, depending on who we have. First, were there any issues that people wanted to talk to in the VC EDU models? So let me bring that over here. So these are the issues. Okay, the one that I thought would be most interesting, let's see. Okay, I think I found it. It's a very long one. It's number 17. If we can figure out this one, this would really help us with a lot of the other, a lot of the use cases that we're trying to demonstrate. So let me share my screen. Oh, I always do that. Share. Okay. This one, we started out talking about, the VC EDU models document talks about a few use cases, but over time we started adding different use cases, and this issue was tracking, like, we want to be very clear up front what's the scope and level of granularity so that we can kind of move forward with this and move any more difficult issues to that may require special attention to something else. So we started calling out what's in scope, what's out of scope. Related to that, and technically, I guess this one might need to be in a different issue. Let's see. So there was a PR to address this issue. So it's PR number 18. And that's where Anthony gave us a good idea of, sort of these are the concepts that we want to express. Now, in the context of that discussion, we came up with the idea of, okay, how do we reuse schema.org types, which are educational occupational credential and well, several things, educational occupational program and a few other things. So let's see how that, okay. So it's a long, if people don't have the context on that, I can dig up the other one, but basically like, so we were originally saying things like person, or trying to say like person has achieved something, or person has credential, person has, you know, something like that. So we talked about all those different things. We were trying to reduce the number of terms that we had, because we wanted to reuse certain types with minimal impact to schema.org. Phil Barker proposed this action. So in schema.org, there is this schema.org action type with a bunch of different subtypes that we may use to relate the person to either the accomplishment or the credential, et cetera. So where we ended up with this is, let's see. Okay, so we were talking, there seemed to be some idea that this might be a useful thing. But then in terms of how this relates to different concepts, you know, let's see. Right, achieved, perform. We might end up having to add all these different properties. And so is there a generic property that could work for specific actions? So, you know, person has executed or has executed action that might apply no matter the action subtype. So yeah, I think this is the thing that I want to move forward the most, because I think we're still trying to land what are the schema.org terms that we need to add that will help unlock, you know, use of schema.org types, which help us better bridge to things like credential engine. So I think that Phil isn't on the call. And I wanted to see if Phil is great. So yeah, Phil, I was curious your thoughts on the sort of, is there a good, you know, what do you think about the approach of introducing a term that applies to sort of the base action type versus needing to get into subtype? So something that says person executed action, and then that might be a perform, achieve, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable approach. I think you were probably right when you say that this perhaps should be a separate issue, because it would be useful to sort out what the actual types of relationship are that we want. You know, if it is just three, then, you know, perhaps adding three properties would be reasonable. If it's going to be more than that, then having a generic property would be better.
Right.
One other thing that I'd like to mention now is that this could be as well as the direct property that you mentioned. So, you know, we could have a property has credential or has achieved, that links directly from the person to the credential or the skill, and we could use the achieve action to provide more information about when that actually happened.
Right. And Jim brings up a good point about person action versus organization action, because I realize this credentialing action, that's my reading of that is more of an organization action. So I wasn't sure.
Yes, the credentialing action is a little bit different. That comes from CTDL, from Credential Engine. And the acting agent is slightly different in that one to the pattern from the others.
Right. Nate, you're up.
Yeah, I was just wondering, if we're thinking about general concepts, is the idea of associating an action with a credential equivalent to associating evidence of achievement with a credential.
Good question.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
It sounds like in our use case that is the case. That's true.
Instance dating.
Well, one of the things that you can associate with an action is, I forget the exact name of the term, but it's something like outcome. You know, it's you know, what the outcome was. So if the action is writes an essay, you can point to the essay that's been written. That might be relevant here.
Right.
The other way to think about verifiable credential is that it's two parts. It's the record of the action or the claim, and then the proof is the issuer's signature. So it's both. Or the evidence is the issuer's signature.
Well, I think they're using evidence in the sense of evidence of like supporting work.
Yeah, like artifact.
Right.
Right. We have this common concept of a defined achievement or a credential that is associated with a particular assessment regime and a specific set of criteria. And the evidence in what in many specs is called the assertion is about what is the documentation that the recipient has met the various pieces of criteria required by the defined achievement.
So we're short on time. I think that it would make sense to pull this out into a separate issue. So one, I think we have made progress on the original issue, and I think that can help inform what are those two things to Phil's question about what are the actions that we still have remaining, and then keep working through the sort of conceptual clarity. I'm not seeing a clear answer right now. I just think we need to iterate more on it in the issue. Checking if anyone has hands raised. Okay, so I think with that we can end a tiny bit early. And so thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Kim.
Thanks, Kim. Thanks, all.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye bye.